This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is a podcast I've been very much looking forward to. The subject of the podcast is fragrance and its potential health hazards. Yeah, I'm talking about all the different perfumes and all the different fragrances that we subject ourselves to, sometimes deliberately, sometimes inadvertently. Great new book, The Case Against Fragrance, by today's guest, Kate Grenville. Kate is one of Australia's most celebrated writers. She's a fiction writer. She has an international bestseller called The Secret River, and she's also written other novels, including Sarah Thornhill, The Lieutenant, Dark Places, The Idea of Perfection. And so it's kind of interesting that she's turned her attention to a nonfiction subject, in fact, a subject kind of an investigative journalist subject. This is a real departure from her. She's coming to us from her home in Australia. Interestingly, we're recording this interview at 5 p.m. New York time. It is 9 a.m. Australia time. So thanks for making the long-distance journey, Kate. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
It's lovely to be here. Thanks for asking me on.
It's my great pleasure. This is a very, very important subject because I don't think a lot of people think of fragrance as being a potential health hazard. But explain to us how you got into this, because, I mean, you're not someone who customarily writes these kinds of books.
That's right. I'm, as you said, a novelist. I've never embarked on this kind of investigative writing before. Look, it came about because I've always known that fragrance made me unwell. You know, when I was young, my mother used perfume for special occasions, as people did back then. We're talking about the 50s. So Mum would use fragrance now and again. You know, when she was going out with Dad, she'd put a little dab of Arpège behind her ears. And so when I got to the age of going out with boys, I thought, all right, I will also get my, you know, signature scent, as they call it. And from then on, for quite a while, I wondered what was wrong with me, because I would go out on a date or go out with friends, and within half an hour, I would have a headache, my eyes would be sore, I would feel kind of cranky and irritable, my brain would kind of close down in such a way that I kind of couldn't think clearly, and all I wanted to do was to go home. So, of course, as you do, I blamed myself. I thought, oh, this is obviously some neurosis about dates or, you know, being sociable.
Some kind of a phobia, you know, some unconscious anxiety reaction in relationship to your first experiences of the opposite sex.
Well, that's right, something like that. I mean, I did though start to see a pattern that if the opposite sex took me out, for example, on a boat — I lived in Sydney at the time, so I knew boys who went sailing — that was fine. So anyway, to cut a long story short, eventually I put two and two together and realized that if I left off the fragrance, didn't put the fragrance on, I was fine. I loved going out. I was extremely sociable, very gregarious. So that was great. And so for the rest of my life, basically, I've known that I just shouldn't wear fragrance. It just didn't agree with me. But I never said anything to anybody because it seemed so peculiar. So about a couple of years ago, I was on a book tour for my the book before Fragrance. And I realized that because I was no longer in my my sort of safe domestic environment, I was suddenly being exposed to a lot of fragrance that was not my own, and it was giving me ferocious symptoms. I realized that my sensitivity had increased. It had gone up several notches. So that now it was not only perfume I wore myself, but perfume that other people were wearing if I was in a closed sort of small space with them. Fragrance diffusers, air fresheners, scented candles, all of those things made life really unbearable. I got to the point where I could no longer enjoy, for example, a concert, because if the person next to me was wearing a lot of fragrance, it would be impossible. But even in a sort of air-conditioned room, the air is basically recycling. So my life was basically being blighted by this problem. And I thought, well, I can't actually be the only person in the world with this problem. I am peculiar, I know, but I can't be completely unique in this way. So I went online very belatedly. Why did it take me so long? And I discovered that far from being the only person in the world, the scientific studies record that 1 in 3 people, a third of the population in the US and also in Australia, get some kind of a health problem from fragrance. Some people, it's headaches, like me. Many people have their asthma triggered by fragrance. Many other people get skin allergies, of course. Hay fever, sore eyes, some people get sick to the stomach. So once I realized that I was not just a weird one-off, I thought, okay, this is something that perhaps should be started to be talked about. That's a very peculiar sentence for a writer to come out with, but this was a subject that really deserved investigation and sharing with people, because it's a kind of a public issue, not just a private one. So that's where that book began.
Indeed. And it's a very comprehensive investigation of the fragrance industry, of the potential health consequences of fragrances. But you know, let's start with a little background on fragrances, because fragrances are as old as civilization. You find tiny vials of perfume in Egyptian tombs. You know, these are made from natural plant and animal derivatives. How has the fragrance industry changed in modern times? I mean, it's certainly a huge industry, a big moneymaker, right?
It certainly is now. As you say, perfumes used to be based on natural products, either plant-based mostly, and musky things from deer, from musk deer. And so for many centuries, they were the only, you had to, you know, distill and macerate and do all sorts of things to the plants to get a little bit of nice-smelling liquid, which is why for centuries perfume has been a marker for a lot of money and therefore a lot of prestige and status. So perfume has always had that connection with kind of desirability and glamour. So what happened in the late 19th century is that chemists got very smart and they realized that they could, first of all, take apart a natural fragrance, for example, the smell of a rose, and they could divide it up into all its constituent chemicals. And in fact, there are about 200 different chemicals in the smell of a rose. And once they had isolated them, they could then synthesize them, because once they isolated them, they could say, okay, well, this is just, and there would then be a chemical formula consisting of, you know, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, usually, which put together in a certain way will produce this particular bit of smell chemical. So once they could do that, huge advantages flowed from that. The biggest, of course, being price. It is so much cheaper to make an artificial smell in a lab than to pick, you know, thousands of baskets full of roses in the south of France and macerate them and so on. So cost is certainly one of them. Those synthetic fragrance chemicals are thousands of times, literally thousands of times cheaper than the real thing. And the other reason why perfumers like the synthetics is that they have complete control over how to combine them. So the rose, nature has chosen to combine those 200 chemicals in the rose in a particular, fairly fixed proportion. You know, it's 1% of beta-damascenone, for example. Pardon me. But once you get these separate chemicals, you can then tinker with the mixture in whichever way you like, and you can have 20% damascenone if that's what you want. So from about the 1880s, when this was first discovered, up till the present, as they're still being discovered and refined, it has been possible to make an amazing array of scents for basically next to nothing. Now, all those synthetics are in fact chemically identical to the chemicals in, for example, the rose. The beta-damascenone that you make in a lab is chemically identical to the one that the rose produces. The big difference is that whereas the rose always only has a tiny bit, about 1% of beta-damascenone to make it smell the way it does, in the lab you can use 20%, 50%, 70%. And that, I think, is one of the places where the problems start to happen. We co-evolved with plants. As humans, we co-evolved with plants. And so we co-evolved to accept and be okay with the particular formula, if you like, that they produced for their smells.
So an analogy would be, you know, that the flavors of modern foods, many of them are artificial, and they jazz our taste buds. They're extremely appetizing and delicious, but that may be something that affects our brains in a certain way that may cause us to select unhealthy foods. And similarly, these formulations are highly, while they are a quote natural, bioidentical in terms of the actual chemical constituents, they're artificial formulations. They're designed to jazz our senses in ways that God and nature didn't intend.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The individual chemicals may be nature identical, but the combination is not. And the other thing, of course, is that more and more of these chemicals are now actually not nature identical. They're actually invented in the lab. So, for example, most of the artificial musks, which used to come from musk deer, are not just synthetic versions of the real thing. They're actually patented inventions in the lab. So the chemists can apparently take a molecule of something and tinker with it in order to make a musk that is, you know, doesn't degrade in light, smells nice, et cetera, et cetera.
As a long shelf life, for example.
Long shelf life, thank you, yes. So that's even worse than the synthetic versions of natural ones, for which the only real problem, I think, is the extremely different proportion and ratio of one chemical to another. But in the case of the musks, which are very, very common in modern perfumes because people like or have been perhaps taught to like that particular kind of smell, they are new chemicals on the planet. You know, the nature has no equivalents for those. And perhaps not surprisingly, the body doesn't know what to do with them. And in the case of artificial musks, the poor old confused body gets this chemical into its system and it thinks, well, I've never actually seen this before, but it looks a little bit like estrogen, so I'm going to accept it as estrogen. So many of these musks are actually hormone mimics or hormone blockers, and that's, as you can imagine, a huge problem.
Indeed. I mean, there's a lot of concern about our estrogenic environment, what are called xenoestrogens, which are foreign or exogenous sources of estrogen. And they're sometimes referred to as gender benders. They actually may confuse our endocrine systems and cause developmental abnormalities, brain abnormalities, maybe particularly dangerous to pregnant women because of the formative stages of gender differentiation. Also, when it comes to cancer, we're seeing an uptick in estrogen-related cancer, breast cancer, uterine cancer, and the like.
That's right. It would be a long bow. No scientist is prepared to say these chemicals are causing an uptick in cancer or hormone-related disorders. But the first of all, the logic is there. if the developing baby in the womb is being, whose development is completely controlled by hormones from the mother's bloodstream, if that baby is exposed to a huge hit of extra, for example, estrogen or the testosterone that it should be getting to be made into a little boy is being blocked. If any of those distortions are happening, then you can imagine that the it would be just logical to see an uptick in all those disorders. And in fact, that's what we're seeing. Now, scientists are very, very cautious people, and I respect them for their caution. And I'm also cautious because I can see that it's easy to make wild leaps between two things which appear to be associated, but which in which one doesn't necessarily cause the other. You know, scientists say association is not causation. Mm-hmm. However, when you have the logic of this, all it means is that the proof is not yet there. And I personally think that the evidence is pretty strong. It can't be proved, but it's pretty strong that a lot of the things that we're happening, that we're seeing, particularly things that are deeply developmental, many kinds of neurological disorders, many kinds of sort of physical and sexual differences, could easily be linked, I think, to the huge overload of distorting hormones that most little children get now, before they're even born.
What are the sources of these fragrances? I mean, because, you know, we're talking about perfumes that are deliberately applied, but what about, you know, what are the range of products that are fragranced?
One of the frightening things about this is how pervasive this all is. It's no longer enough to just choose yourself not to wear fragrances, as I did for all those years. So we now have, because fragrances are so cheap and because they're still linked with glamour and status, we now have a world where it is almost impossible not to be saturated in these chemicals one way or another all day. So laundry detergent, for example, is up against our skin. The residue of that fragrance is up against our skin 24 hours a day when you think about it, pajamas, sheets, and then the clothes we wear during the day. So that's already a 24-hour exposure to chemicals, which, you know, science has established that they are hormone disruptors. Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, you know, when you smell something, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the molecular basis of smell is that your nose is sensing very, very small concentrations of molecules, just as your light sensors in your eyes are sensing electromagnetic waves from the environment. Your nose is like a very, very sensitive chemical detector, and that's how we navigate through the world, you know, through appealing scents and through dangerous scents. Your nose is a chemical detector. So what we're picking up is we're picking up traces of chemicals whenever something has an odor.
That's exactly right. It's actual bits, actual molecules of the chemicals that are going up our nose and hitting the receptors in there, and that's then triggering a reaction in a part of our brain which is right there. You know, the molecules land on those receptors, mm-hmm. and the olfactory bulb is separated from the real world. Pardon me. Is separated from the world by virtually nothing. Mm-hmm. So it's actual bits. The other thing, of course, is that the skin can absorb many of those chemicals. Mm-hmm. Some of them go straight through virtually, and certainly children's delicate skin is very much more absorbent than adults. Plus, of course, we're breathing it into our lungs from which mm-hmm. it's going straight to our bloodstream. Mm. So we're getting that through everything in the world. You know, it's very hard. I don't know about where you are, but where I am, it's now quite hard to go shopping without walking into a wall of fragrance.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I noticed that you have to run the gauntlet when you go to a department store, because many of the really best department stores have a cosmetic and fragrance department on the first floor, and you have to kind of quickly move past that if you want to buy clothes on the upper floors. Similarly, you know, when I try to buy shaving cream, I have to look high and low for fragrance-free shaving cream. And sometimes I say, what the heck? I'll get, you know, the regular kind. It's just as good. And I have a couple of cans of shaving cream that are unusable because they just make me feel sick when I use them. And they, and even the ones that say low fragrance or natural fragrance doesn't help.
Yeah, look, it's an interesting point. We should talk about that idea of natural fragrance, because people often say to me, what about essential oils? And it's a very good question. You know, the original basis of perfume.
Can we hold that? Can we hold that issue over for part two, because we divide our podcast into two parts? That's a good departure point for part two, because, you know, surely we want to avoid unnatural things, unnatural chemicals in our food, unnatural fragrances. What about natural fragrances? Is there a problem? Our guest, Kate Grenville, has done a deep dive on the subject in her book, The Case Against Fragrance. And in part two, we'll take up some other issues related to our ubiquitous, chemically laden environment. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.